It's Insight on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. My name's Mark Farrell. Feels like we're all living in Seattle right here in the Big Apple, La Grande Manzana. The weather here for the last couple days, 4 or 5 days, has been wet, very humid, followed by more wetness. It's just enough is enough. Apparently on Saturday, we're supposed to dry up. But if you're in Seattle right now listening to us, a couple hours earlier, I feel your pain. So if you want to move out here, I wouldn't blame you, because this is a little bit crazy. You know, it's a great way to start your day, like, on a positive note. And about twice a week, I run into somebody who has a major influence on me. And it's kind of funny, because I teach spin at an ungodly hour, Tuesdays and Thursday mornings at 5:30 in the morning. So I'm usually cruising out of my house about 4:45, 5 a.m. And chances are, I run into my newspaper carrier. Now, it's not the newspaper carriers you and I were when we were young. These people drive because they're adults. They used to pay, I think, pretty good money. But this guy carries every paper known to man. New York Times, Daily News, Post, local papers by me, USA Today. And he couldn't be any nicer. What an industrious guy. I mean, this guy, so we shoot the breeze. Basically, I see him in the morning, and now it's a double-edged sword because I love talking to the guy. But next thing you know, I start shooting breeze with the guy. 15 minutes goes by, and now it's like 5:05. I got to rush like hell, make a mad dash to the gym so I can get to my class and get it off on schedule. But this guy is such a good dude. I mean, he's a workaholic. And so positive, man. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. He's a ray of sunshine. He's just a cool dude. And he's got like a couple hundred papers that he does. It takes him 2.5 to 3 hours to deliver this. And I look in his car and I don't see anything in bags, and it's raining out. I'm like, how do you bag these? He goes, I drive and bag. I'm like, isn't that against the law? So what he does is he drives with his knees. That's comforting everybody, right? He drives with his knees, sticks the newspaper into the bag as he approaches the house because he delivers like 6 or 7 different papers. So I guess it would be kind of very, who knows, difficult. It's a skill. And wham, he drops it right out, puts it right on your doorstep. Anyway, so it's pretty cool when you start your day off like that. You know, a nice positive influence. It's kind of a cool thing. And then, of course, I opened a paper this morning and I'm reminded today's the start of the World Cup. But not too many people are cheering in Brazil. No, they're totally bummed because, of course, you know, Brazil is quite poverty stricken. And but they love soccer, but they're torn because the country is, you know, in turmoil financially. But they spent millions upon millions of dollars on stadiums. First of all, some of them are not complete. Yeah, you know, I always thought about this when we talk about Olympics, stadiums not being finished in time. Well, this is the reality for Brazil, for the World Cup. 4 weeks of games, and some of the facilities aren't done. It's crazy. And you know what's even crazier is that they built the stadium in the middle of nowhere, but guess where the stadium is? In the rainforest. That's right, in the rainforest. Why would you build a stadium in the rainforest? Number one, I mean, that's a protected area, or should be protected. I don't know what Brazil's laws are. Obviously, they're not protecting their rainforest. So what they had to do is, because there were no roads out to this facility, or soon-to-be-built facility, or now new facility, so they had to barge all the supplies down, oh, I forget the name of this river. Famous river. Anyway, so this thing is built. So they're predicting, okay, once the World Cup is finished, and by the way, count them, 1, 2, 3, 4 games will be played there. That's it. Once that fourth game is done, padlock the doors, and who knows when it's going to be used again. A complete and utter waste of money. So a lot of the local Brazilians have been protesting this for months because they're so inflamed about the gross waste of finances on facilities that are going to go dormant, waste to pot. Okay, maybe they said, oh, we'll get a few concerts here and there. But I guess Pitbull and J-Lo, who are opening the ceremonies today, the games, won't be coming back probably. You know, actually, it's pretty funny because J-Lo was going to be doing the opening games or opening kickoff for the World Cup. And then she said, well, logistically, I can't really do it. And I think she got so much flack. She got so much shit for canceling on such a world platform. I mean, it's the world's biggest sporting event. 4 weeks. And so she said, okay, we'll work it out. We'll work it out. Our tour manager will work it out. Logistically, we'll do it. So she is on. But the question is, like, why are all these facilities built? And this is the larger question for Olympics, the Olympic committee that, you know, demands that X amount of facilities, depending on the winter or summer games, have to be built. And so there's a great actual special on Inside Sports on HBO that studied all these facilities. There's actually a gentleman who just been for the last 15, 20 years been researching all these facilities internationally and how they go to waste. So a lot of these buildings are so poorly planned logistically and for the future that they can't be converted to housing, pro facilities, et cetera. So unfortunately, a lot of these go to waste. So it's really kind of terrible. So 32 teams, 4 weeks, and FIFA, the organizing body of soccer, rakes in some major dinero. They get all the ticket sales. They get all the merch money. They get all the sponsors. What does the host country get? Squat. Do you believe that? Squat. I cannot believe it. Why would you want to host such a great endeavor, gargantuan endeavor, and get no financial, you know, outcome, profit? That's lame, really, really lame. FIFA is pretty bad. Actually, they got a serious thing going on nowadays because a lot of African-American players, believe it or not, it's hard to believe that in this day and age are getting some racial slurs yelled at them at European country games. And so that they have their hands full. But America plays on Monday. That's right. We have a team. We've assembled for the World Cup. And then they'll probably be catching a flight home on Monday afternoon. But it's really Brazil's World Cup to lose. I mean, they pretty much have it in the bag, and they'll do well. And America, even one of the American coaches, I think, were quoted as saying, well, we're not going to be really doing that well. I mean, what kind of, you know, I guess the Gipper wouldn't be saying something like that, wouldn't have said something like that. But what kind of inspiration, what kind of courage and like fortitude are you giving your players when you're saying, well, it's not looking too good? Oh, man. So anyway, good luck to all the teams out there, and good luck to you international listeners if your team is playing, because don't worry about the U.S. We'll be getting out of your way mighty quickly. And the other thing, of course, I saw this morning when I opened the paper was, you know, the shootings are still in the headlines. It's just unfathomable. I mean, you think about it. Since it's 2014, halfway through the year, so since 2012, the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, where, what was it, 20 students and 6 adults were shot to death, there have been 74 shootings in the past 18 months. 74. It's really unfathomable. And it makes me start to think, like, I don't, and that's including this past Tuesday shooting in Oregon. Are Americans becoming desensitized? Is this less shocking nowadays for us? I don't know. Are we accepting of this new horrific violence as becoming the new norm? It's bad. You know, gun control, actually one of the headlines is that the NRA is being completely and utterly silent about this because the last shooting on Tuesday in Oregon was with a shotgun. So we need stronger legislation, totally need stronger legislation, because the only way this is going to change, in my eyes, is with stronger gun control laws. Yes, they can still happen. If there's a will, there's a way. People will get their hands on a gun, whether it be a shotgun, rifle, pistol, you name it. But, you know, the only way we can do this is you got to hold your officials responsible. I mean, contact your senators, your governor. Make it stop. We have to make this stop because this is just unconscionable. I mean, I have a kid who's going to be 5 and a daughter who's going to be 2. So who knows what it's going to be like when they're in high school? But actually, what am I saying? It's not even high school ever. Look at Newtown, Connecticut. Those kids were young. There was an elementary school where 20 kids died and 6 adults. Oof. All right, I got to move on because this is pretty damn depressing. Well, you know what? Something's pretty cool that, you know, if you're a fan of Jim Carrey, you either love him or hate him. And I love the guy. I've actually been told I resemble him, but I don't see that. Jeff Daniels actually is in a great HBO show called Newsroom. If you haven't seen him, he's a totally different character. in this role. But remember 1994? Yeah, where big hair was kind of still in, a little bit fading out? Well, the classic film Dumb and Dumber is back. Yes. I think it was one of the best films of all time. It set the stage for so many movies to come. And Dumb and Dumber 2, spelled T-O, not T-O-O or the number 2. The Farrelly brothers, you know, waited 20 years and it's back. And I saw the trailer. So if you haven't seen the trailer, go on to YouTube and check it out, because it's really, I mean, it's the humor that was in the first movie taken to a higher degree. I think it's going to be fantastic. So it got me thinking, like, okay, 1994, 2014, 20 years later, what's really changed in society? Are we any brighter? Are we dumber? So I started thinking, okay, what happened back in 1994? Remember Tonya Harding, of course. She introduced to Nancy Kerrigan a metal pipe via an accomplice. I think it was her ex-husband or ex-fiancé at the time. You remember that? God, unbelievable. Of course, Nancy Kerrigan still went on to win and compete, and she won a silver medal. Good for her. 1994. So dumber. So in 2014, who would be like a parallel for Tonya Harding? That's a no-brainer. Kim Kardashian and Kanye West. Enough said? Yeah. sports-wise, 1994, remember, come August, no baseball. What a drag that was. Major League Baseball players strike. No World Series. A complete drag. What's dumber than that? What can trump that? Donald Sterling. Soon to be the former owner of the LA Clippers. And shockingly, perhaps a billionaire. I don't think he'll be a billionaire, but they're still fighting that and going to court, I think, next week. And in 1994, of course, this started what was to become years and years until President Obama recently said we're going to be getting out of Afghanistan. But we sent forces to the Persian Gulf. And what's dumber than that? Well, this is a little bit of a lighter wink, wink, dumber aspect. But the healthcare.gov site, failure to launch. Way to go, Obama. Mea culpa on you. Cigarettes were pretty damn dumb in 1994, but we got a solution that's even dumber in 2014. Electronic cigarettes. The benefits and risk of electronic cigarettes use are uncertain. So give it a whirl. Give it a puff. Get back to us in 10, 15 years after you either have lung cancer or die of cancer of some part of your body. 1994, the record of the year. Let me preface this by saying it's been almost 2 years since this woman, musician, great musician, died. So it's okay. Statute of limitations of not being able to make fun of somebody has passed. It elapsed. So Whitney Houston came out with a song that I just cringed at every time I heard of it. I Will Always Love You. And she won in 1994. Dumber, of course, this is a no-brainer. Gangnam Style. Yes, absolutely dumber. 95 million viewers watch O.J. Simpson's infamous very, very slow pursuit car chase on the L.A. freeways. And what's even dumber than that? Could you possibly think that if you closed the George Washington Bridge, you would get away with it? Really? Chris Christie, did you really think you'll get away with it? That federal prosecution is still doing their job, and the outcome will be resolved soon, I think, and guilty parties will be revealed. Okay, remember Don Juan DeMarco, the movie, 1994? You probably don't because it didn't do too well, but if you did see it, you saw Johnny Depp, not his worst, but yeah, pretty far down there. But even more sad was for Marlon Brando. I mean, this is an icon of an actor. Johnny Depp is now an icon of an actor, but Marlon Brando, I mean, they're two different classes of actors. Marlon Brando, I was just sad to see him in this movie, and it was just sad and horrible and deplorable in everything you could say about a movie. And if you don't know about it, don't feel bad, because that says a lot to how well it did. Now, the dumber version of this for 2014, now I want to say, would be The Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise movie. But unfortunately, I have to say that people are going out to see it. Yeah, so I can't say it's the dumber movie, because they're saying that this blockbuster actor is back. And so I'm kind of bummed about that, because I was really, really psyched to trash the guy. So instead, I'm going to make the dumber movie a movie that has not been released yet. So I'm going to make a prediction that the Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, that comes out in July, actually July 11th, will be the dumber movie of 2014. Dumb in 1994, Don Juan DeMarco. Dumber, dumbest, and dumbest still probably will be Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And if you're with me on, if you're on board with the whole, you know, Tom Cruise thing, then you can also say Edge of Tomorrow. But, you know, I wonder why it took the Farrelly brothers almost two decades to come up with a sequel. Well, since they're kind of almost related to me, except with the L-Y on the end of their name, maybe somehow my paths will cross at some family reunion somewhere in America someday. So they say, you know, it makes you feel good to give to people. Do you feel that way? Well, I feel really good when I receive. Don't you? Isn't that the point of having a birthday? The holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah. Hey, even Father's Day in a couple of days. Are you going to feel ultra good, ultra special, dads, when you get a gift? Home Depot, new shirt. Hopefully it's not a tie again. Ties suck for gifts. Okay, let's just put it out there. You're not going to pick out the one we really want to wear when we do wear them, when we actually have to wear them. So don't go the tie route. Be creative. But anyway, but there's someone out there, a lot of people actually, and there's actual doctor, Dr. Stephen Post, best-selling author. He's a professor of preventative medicine and bioethics. We have to have him define that. Bioethics at Stony Brook University Medical School. He's written a lot of books, best-selling author of Why Good Things Happen to Good People, the exciting new research that proves the link between doing good and living a longer, healthier life. My pleasure to welcome Dr. Stephen Post to the show. Hello.
Hi, Mark. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you. I'm glad you're there.
I'm here.
What do you got for me? You got something good to give me so I feel very good and you feel even more healthy?
Well, I could give you a good joke or two, and that's not bad. A little mirth tends to make you more resistant to infections, in fact.
Really?
It infects the immune system a bit.
So when I started reading about this, I have to say, to be honest with you, because I'm an honest kind of guy, I believe in candor, that I'm like, well, what is this really about? Is this a bunch of, you know what? But then I realized, you know what, I'm an athlete, and I feel really good when I train for marathons, long distance cycling, et cetera. So there's a lot to be said about euphorism, dopamine, et cetera. Is there a parallel to this?
There is a parallel, because when you look at the studies of individuals who are in a laboratory, they're hooked up to a brain imaging device, and they're asked to just contemplate how they would like to contribute or give to others. They check a line item with something like the local Alzheimer's Association or your alma mater school or whatever. They check that item, and a part of the brain lights up. It's called, you listeners don't need to write this down, it's called the mesolimbic pathway.
Can you spell that?
No, I don't want to try.
No, okay, good.
There somewhere.
I know you're smarter than me. I didn't know how much smarter.
No. I take it as a grain of salt.
But listen, okay, good.
So this is a very deeply evolved part of the brain. It's the part of the brain that's associated with feelings of exhilaration and happiness. It doles out one of the big four happiness chemicals, dopamine, and that actually gets active when you're thinking about helping other people, and that's the same part of the brain that's active when you're out for a long jog and feeling exhilarated.
Is there a link in all your studies, and we're going to get to your studies, Dr. Post, between a lot of people, and there's a psychological phenomenon, a term that I don't know what it's called, applied to this scenario, but when people are much more giving, like excessively, but don't help themselves?
Oh, yeah. There is a big problem, especially if you're in a helping profession. I work in a medical center, and we are constantly struggling with burnout. Good clinicians who get into these fields with every kind of ideal to be caring and compassionate and stay with it all of their lives, they wind up getting depressed. They wind up getting demoralized and ultimately leaving the practice of medicine. So you can definitely overdo it. And the key word is balance. You got to have balance. All these studies that say, yeah, a couple of hours of volunteering a week is good for you, it makes you happier, live a little longer, be healthier, that's all true. But those are folks who aren't involved day in and day out in helping others as a professional activity.
Do you believe this is something that's genetic or innate, that you are a giver? There are givers and takers in this world, and we all know the takers. They really stand out much more than the givers. But do you feel that this is something that you're born with, or is something that you realize that it's just a good thing to develop into, morph into?
Some people are a little more prone to giving than others. Some have a little stronger capacity for empathy and compassion. There's no doubt about it, but that's not determinative. I mean, in life, as you go down the journey, you get non-parent mentors, you get in the right communities, you find inspiration, a light goes on, but there's no doubt that there's about a third of people who just take to giving like a duck to water, and there's another two-thirds that don't have the easiest time in the world getting to it, but about half of those eventually will also feel this light go on, and their emotions will catch up with their giving. So that's actually pretty well established when you look at the high school kids in service-based learning way back from 1992 when that started. So definitely there's some nature, but there's an awful lot of nurture. And then there's also just kind of, you know, what you decide to do with your life. There's a little bit of individual responsibility here, too.
That's why we're all on heavy medication here, because we're in radio.
Right.
We made the wrong decision. I'm just kidding. I love what I do. Now, explain to me, did I read this correctly, Dr. Post, that you conducted a 50-year study?
No, I didn't conduct that, but we studied it. This is a study that goes back.
You studied a study.
Yeah. We actually.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. It goes back to the mid-1920s, and we funded Paul Wink and some other individuals to review all this data and to look at the subject pool. But this was about 300 12-year-olds in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's, let's say, 1926. And investigators asked them what rocked their boat, what made them happy, what motivated them in life. And about a third, 100 of the 300, again, these are 12-year-olds, said, well, I want to use my gifts to help others. Then the researchers from Berkeley followed these kids over the next 50 years of their lives. They interviewed them every 10 years, psychological tests. They looked at their medical records. And it turns out that that high motivated group, that 100, had lower levels of depression, lower levels of heart disease, interestingly enough. And now that about 70 or 80 of them are still actually living and they're well into their 90s, definitely about two-thirds of the ones who are still alive come from the one-third who, as 12-year-olds, had that kind of give-and-glow attitude. So I don't have a model for it, but there's something about thinking in these terms that tends to help people flourish over the course of a lifetime, with exceptions, because, you know, there's a lot of good people who at age 25 get hit by a car, get some sudden diagnosis. But as a scientific generalization, it's good to be good.
I think we all know the people in our lives on both extremes, people who are just kind of happy-go-lucky, positive, affable people. And that, in my eyes, that's actually giving in itself, because you're giving to yourself, because, you know, life has a lot of stresses. It's difficult, health situations, financial, personal, etc. And you can choose. I think you can make a conscious decision whether you want to be a victim or you want to help yourself out and to be happy and to realize that, you know, you are driving this vehicle in your life. And so there are things you can do and things you can avoid to make yourself happier. So there are, I think, easy steps that cost absolutely nothing. And it's called giving, however, in whatever form, and nothing monetary. It could be of your time. Even the simplest, gracious, smallest act of just saying hello to somebody during the course of a day can make them feel happier.
Yeah, very much so. Hey, I have to tell you a story. About 4 years ago, my colleagues and I had an article out on how widows and widowers who'd been married happily for a long time before husband or wife died, how they were having an easier time getting through grief and bereavement if they could report small acts of helping, small acts of giving in their environment from them to others, or if they were volunteering a bit. So I gave this talk. I got invited by this Association of Widows and Widowers. They had a big annual meeting in some big hotel along the Long Island Expressway, and I gave this talk, and the Q&A session went pretty well until the last question came from a guy in the back of the room, and he stood up and he said, "I don't care what you say, buddy. I don't do nothing for nothing."
I love it. Of course.
So, you know, if you think tit for tat, if you think everything's got to be reciprocal gain payback, if that's what you're thinking, you know, it can limit you. But if you get beyond that and realize that there's a kind of internal gratification and joy and flow involved with this, you don't worry so much. It's more pay it forward than it is pay it back.
And that's what I think genuine people who give do it for that reason. I do know a few people, actually, who get very crestfallen because they feel that they give, and get nothing in return. And I want to say to them, you know, you put yourself out there. You're vulnerable. And I think people realize that and expect that you're doing it because you want to, not because you expect something in return.
Oh, yeah. If you are depending on everybody clapping, giving you accolades.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, you think they're all going to be singing at your funeral. I'm sorry. But the bottom line is that, as a generalization, a byproduct of authentic giving and helping, you know, within limits, of course, physical and psychological, is that people do feel happier, they feel gratified, they're able to be more resilient in the hard moments of life. They are able to make deeper friendships, the studies show. They are happier, they feel healthier. It's a long list, but it's pretty good to be good.
Dr. Post is joining me on Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. His new book is Why Good Things Happen to Good People, properly titled. Do you feel that we talked about, you know, the easy ramifications of you just literally feel good when you do something, even just a simple act of holding a door. Talk about more the physical implications or results of doing things and that make people healthy. How tangible, concrete are those results? How are they measured?
They're very tangible. If you look at, there's now 7 or 8 big population studies on older adults between, say, ages 70 and 90 or 65 and 85, basically 20-year windows. And what they show after you factor out all of the background variables is that older adults who are involved in giving, in being generative and helpful, they have significantly lower depression rates, and they're living longer on average by how much? Probably a couple of years. So if you thought that when you retire, the first thing you want to do is get to Sun City so you can rise up at noon and have your first martini.
Yeah, baby.
Yes, you know, think again. There might be a better option. You go to all these assisted living centers, and they have whole wings now involving older adults in walk-a-thons, you know, putting the print on shirts for the local bike-a-thon. It's really caught on because the studies are so conclusive. And, you know, there are studies on a chemical called oxytocin that tends to be released when people are involved in helping activities. And that's a chemical that is associated with feelings of serenity or tranquility. And so suddenly you can understand, say, those old Norman Rockwell pictures of the Golden Rule on the Saturday Evening Post.
Sure, absolutely.
Everybody's thinking Golden Rule, and there's a kind of a peacefulness about them all, whether they're men or women, young or old, whatever their race or ethnicity might be. When they get into that mindset, it kind of switches off those negative emotions, those hostile emotions, and moves you into a better space.
Interesting. It's a different chemical than dopamine, but nonetheless a welcomed one.
Yeah, yes, and it's one of the happiness-related chemicals, definitely, yes.
And finally, Dr. Post, if people don't feel that they fit this mold, they're not givers, they're takers, or they just feel like, you know what, I just don't believe in this, what would you say to them? I mean, it's never too late, of course, to try, and it doesn't take much exertion to actually be someone who's a giver.
Right, just experiment a bit. Take a couple of hours a week for
and
6 weeks.
And send anything you like to Mark Farrell, care of PRN.FM.
Well, do that first.
Yeah, exactly.
But the thing is, you know, you need to have some activity that lights your fire. I mean,
Hello.
We know is that people need to be doing something that they're engaged with and care about. They need to be doing it from strength, so they're not just spinning their wheels and feel like they're not making a difference. And if they can get together in groups sometimes and kind of debrief on their activities, that helps a lot, too, studies show. But basically, if you do this for just a couple of hours a week for 6 weeks, see how you feel, and you should feel pretty good.
And very quickly, Dr. Post, do you have siblings?
I have an older sister.
How do you differ? Are you both givers?
I think maybe I'm a little more of a giver than my sister is, but in her own way, she's a giver too.
When's your birthday?
May 6th.
What did she send you? There you go. Enough said. Dr. Post, thank you so much for your time. What's your website?
The best website is www.unlimitedloveinstitute.com.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Is that G or X?
Unlimited.
Is that a 1995 a month website? Or what are we talking here, Doctor?
Yeah, it's a great website. What kind of love are we talking about?
Just
the generous love that we've been talking about here.
Okay.
But, it was founded in 2001, the Institute, with the help of Sir John Templeton.
Yes, so, and we didn't get to all your fantastic work with persons with Alzheimer's. And I also wanted to speak to you about Barbara Smith, an iconic model and restaurateur on many levels, who just recently got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. But we wish her and all the best, and we wish you continued success on making people understand the importance of giving and also your crucial work with people with Alzheimer's.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
All the best, Doctor.
Okay, take care.
When Insight continues, we're going to find out where disabled veterans end up. A lot of them have come home from across the lines internationally after giving of their lives and losing of their limbs, and more. Find out next what happens to them, where they end up and reside when Insight continues on PRN.FM. All right, Ranger Mania is alive and well. We hope. The Rangers didn't allow a sweep last night. They won! Yes, they're still alive. Next game, Friday night, Game 5 in L.A. Let's bring it back to New York City, guys. Do your thing. Had a kind of a cool thing happen to me this morning. You know, New York City moment, which is very, very cool. We all like to see these in a good way, I'm talking about. I'm on a subway, and I hear this noise, cacophony of noise coming down at the complete other end of the subway car. And it's this gentleman. I call him the Can Man. He must have, I mean, there are bags upon bags. People had to clear out of the corner of the subway. I have a picture of it. I'll actually put it on PRN.FM's website under Insight. He must have had, if he had one can, he had 1,000 cans, maybe even more, because he took up nearly, I'd say, a third of the car. No embellishment. How much is that worth? I have no idea, but I'm sure he can get a good meal out of it. It makes you realize the industrious people who are a part of New York City. So maybe your son, brother, sister, daughter, friend graduated high school. They enlisted in the service, served their country. Maybe they got injured. Maybe they're disabled. They came home. They didn't have a job, perhaps a place not to live, a residence to call their own, a fresh start. Where do they go? How do they start over? There's an organization called Homes for Our Troops that's been around for quite some time, and they're doing just that, giving people who served their country, put their life on the line, and unfortunately became disabled, maimed in a process, and come home. Came home, met the qualifications, and now they have, or soon will have, a house, compliments of Homes for Our Troops. My guest right now is Bill Ivey. He's the executive director. Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Doing great, Mark. How are you today?
All right. Probably a little bit more rested than you, because you're probably still tired after serving 31 years in the Army.
Not only that, but I stayed up to watch a Rangers win one last night.
Oh, now I really like you, Bill. You feeling good about that?
Absolutely.
You think they're going to do it?
They might have to pick up their game a little bit.
Yeah, they will.
But it was a good game.
They will. Well, unfortunately, whatever the outcome is, you're going to be certainly doing more than fledgling, because Homes for Our Troops is doing such phenomenal work. The fact that you build specialty adapted homes for severely injured veterans across the nation, you know, enabling them to rebuild their lives is just priceless.
It's a great opportunity. Homes for Our Troops is a privately funded 501c3 organization, and we built specially adapted homes for our most severely disabled veterans. So most of our veterans are multiple amputees, paraplegic, quadriplegic, or severe traumatic brain injury stemming from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And what we try to do is get them into a home that's completely accessible to them, that restores the freedom and independence that they've sacrificed defending mm-hmm. our freedom and independence. And that gives them an opportunity to get on with rebuilding their lives, which is what we really want to help them do.
I can't imagine, Bill, how overwhelming it must be. Number one, all veterans, whether you lost a limb or not, come home disabled, because psychologically, you know, they've seen and experienced a lot. Obviously, there are varying degrees, because it depends on where you were stationed, what kind of battle. Maybe you didn't see any battle, but there are all kinds of ramifications. We know it about the suicide rates and all the services, branches of services. So it is a hard, hard, arduous job, no matter how you come home. Unfortunately, some people come home a lot worse off, and now you don't have a place to live. You're disabled. You don't have a job. You know, have no idea what the future holds. But here comes Homes for Our Troops. And it's pretty amazing because now if you have somebody who lives in the middle of the country and they say, I want to live in, say, Wisconsin, can you accommodate them?
Absolutely, Mark. We have so far built 166 homes in 38 different states.
Wow.
We have 24 that are in various stages of construction and another 33 that we're looking for land. So we build as close to where the veteran wants to live as reasonable. You know, if he wants to live in downtown New York City, we probably can't afford that. But we'll get him as close as we can to accommodate where he wants to live, because what we're trying to do is build a totally accessible home that will be mortgage-free to him, where he can spend the rest of his life, raise a family, have the grandkids come over, and it'll accommodate him for the rest of his life.
And this is at absolutely no cost whatsoever to the vet.
Absolutely. The only thing we ask of the veterans in return is to help us what we call pay it forward by getting the word out about Homes for Our Troops, referring other veterans to us that are severely disabled so that we can help them get on with rebuilding their lives.
I'm sure they have no problem doing that, Bill.
They don't. And they do it in different ways. You know, some are more extroverted than mm-hmm. others, and they're tremendous public speakers for us. Others prefer not to be in the public eye, but do great in terms of starting fundraisers and supporting us in other ways.
Now, would they have to pay their property taxes?
Yes, they do. What we try to do is we set them up for success in rebuilding their lives. So when we move them into a home mortgage-free, at that point, we have already hooked them up or linked them up with a financial plan or pro bono so that they have a good, strong financial plan going into home ownership. And then we go through what we call home ownership 101, because most of our veterans, as you would imagine, are in their 20s, mm-hmm. fairly young. Quite often, this is the first home they've had the opportunity to own.
Sure. Not too long ago, they were still playing Xbox.
Exactly. So all the things that some of us have learned the hard way in buying homes over the years, we want to save them that problem so that we're setting them up for success. So they do assume the taxes. They do assume the insurance. We talked to them about putting aside money each month for maintenance and repairs and all the things that come with home ownership.
And after several years go by, 6 years or so, they accrue 20% of the house and so on up to 100% in 10 years?
Correct. What we do is we, although the home is mortgage-free to our veterans, we put a lien on it so that we protect the veteran and we protect your organization so that, for example, they can't flip the house and go live in a trailer. Or someone who wants to, well-meaning, use the equity in their home to start a small business doesn't do well, the veteran loses their home. So the first 5 years, they have no equity in the home. Beginning in the sixth year, as you said, they accrue 20% until the 10-year mark. They completely have 100% equity in the home.
Now, I want to read this because, I mean, this doesn't sound like much, but if you think about all these different aspects of building a home, it is a gargantuan undertaking. Homes have over 155 special adaptations, for full access to the home for the veteran, wider halls, doorways, automatic door openers, roll under sinks, stovetops, counters, pull-down shelving, house generators, sliding windows, roll-in shower with digital temperature control, master bedroom closet that is a steel-reinforced concrete storm room built to FEMA standards. I have one of those. That's where I keep my beer cold.
That's a good place to do it. It'll be safe. Sure, tornado will come your way.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's depending on logistically where you're located, Bill, the last one, right?
Well, we do build it into all the homes.
You do?
We do. As we go forward here, as we continue to balance bringing revenue in to build homes, we're looking at retrofitting homes, particularly the ones that are in areas that are prone to tornadoes that were built before we had that feature, and go back and retrofit those with a storm room.
Now, all the homes that you're providing to these veterans, very fortunate veterans, well-deserved veterans, they are new construction. Why not renovate? Because you don't even want to bother going down that track of not knowing what the condition, the history, et cetera, of a house?
That's part of it, Mark. The other part is we have a fairly standard design that we've developed over the past 10 years of our existence that is a single-level slab-on-grade that we find that works out best to provide the veteran a right-sized home. Our homes are approximately 2,650 square feet.
It's nice size.
A four-bedroom home. It's a nice home, but what it does is give a young veteran an opportunity, if he is married or may get married in the future, it's big enough to raise a family, to stay there and not have to move out because it becomes too small. And the new construction, of course, gives an opportunity to get him into a home where he's not going to have older home or rehabilitated home problems going forward.
Bill Ivey, Executive Director for Homes for Our Troops. I imagine the fee for the land, materials, supplies, labor, et cetera, varies from East Coast, middle of the country, West Coast, et cetera. So what's the average cost for building one of these homes?
Mark, outside of California, we average about $430,000 to buy the land, build a home, and the materials and labor goes into building it.
In total, California, 430?
430.
Not bad.
It's pretty good. We have a number of folks that work very hard at getting the best deal that we can, of course. We are, of course, privately funded, so we're working on bringing in those donations and also bringing in corporate sponsors. Over 90 cents on the dollar that we bring in goes to direct support of the veterans. So
wow, that's great.
We don't spend a lot of money on advertising, so we use word of mouth to try to get it.
And who are some of your major sponsors, a few of those?
We have Kohler donates high-end fixtures for the homes.
Sure.
Armstrong donates flooring for the homes. Mastic donates siding. CertaPro does painting for us. Blue Line Rental provides equipment on the construction site.
Are the contractors doing this at a reduced fee, or is it subsidized by any manner?
We run the full gamut. We have some contractors, general contractors, that are build partners who donate all their time, labor, and effort. Some do it as a reduced fee, and some we pay full price for.
And quickly, before we meet somebody who is a recipient of a house in the West Coast, Justin Bond, let's hear from you about the upcoming construction that's going to be taking place in New York in a few weeks.
Absolutely. We have a Marine sergeant who lost both his legs on his third tour in Afghanistan, who will be living in Manorville, New York, out on Long Island. And on Saturday, the 19th of July, we'll have a groundbreaking ceremony for his home, and we'll begin construction at that time to hopefully get him into a home before Christmas.
Now, I imagine you have project managers on site, et cetera. Do you need volunteers of this nature?
What we do like is we try to get out folks to both the groundbreaking to make awareness, because one of the best things we can get the community to do is to welcome this veteran and his family into the community and, again, provide that support as they get on with rebuilding their lives. Approximately 30 days before we have a key ceremony to move the veteran and his family into the home, we have a volunteer day where we try to get the community out to lay sod, plant mm-hmm. bushes, do right. landscaping, wipe down the house, and get the home ready for the veteran and his family to move in.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like you're doing some phenomenal work. And, Bill, you are a private 501c3 nonprofit. Is this because the organization Homes for Our Troops tried to have a relationship and or establish something with the government and it didn't work out, decline, or is this something a conscious decision to stay extremely private and separate?
It was a conscious decision to stay private. It was started as a private organization, individuals getting together to form the organization back in 2004. It has obviously grown. At that time, we were doing one or two homes a year. Now we're doing in the 32 homes per year. And, of course, we're working to increase our revenue to the point where we can to build more than 40 or 50 homes a year. We estimate, looking at the numbers with the Veterans Administration, that there's probably somewhere between 1,200 and 1,700 severely injured veterans coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And so that's a pretty big backlog that we and other organizations need to work on.
That's a lot of stick American homes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Bill Ivey, all the best to you. Have you met Justin Bond, Bill?
I have not had the opportunity to meet him yet. I know
Bill,
him and know who he is.
Bill, say hello to Justin. Hello, Justin, and welcome to the show.
Justin, how are you doing today?
Okay, I'm looking at my engineer here to see if we have Justin still on the phone. Justin's on the line, but maybe he put the phone down for a second. So, Bill, you and I are going to keep talking.
Outstanding.
And let me ask you a question here. After serving such a long time in the infantry, which, by the way, my father was a captain in WW2. He was an infantryman as well. And a side note that my sister and I actually just relived recently from Memorial Day. As a child, we'd be standing along the parade route, and every time a military personnel rode by us or walked by us, he would salute them, and we would be completely and utterly embarrassed. But what a stand-up guy my father was. He's not around anymore. He died several years ago. But for still taking his role in the military and as Americans so seriously.
Well, and of course, as you know, he was a member of the Greatest Generation, as was my father. And I am very privileged to have an opportunity to serve with an organization such as Homes for Our Troops that is now being able to take care of the members of the current Greatest Generation. To have been injured defending our country.
So you would have been embarrassed as well, though, right? Come on, it's okay.
Yeah, I might have been in my younger days.
Yeah, sure, sure, sure.
I have a tendency to do it now, so probably embarrassing my kids, although the one who's going to be in the Army here in another year should be, I don't think she'd be embarrassed.
Oh, good for her. And let's check to see if Justin's back on the line. Justin, you there? So what do you know about Justin? You haven't met Justin in person, Bill, but what do you know about his story? Certainly he's a dual above the knee amputee, has lived through a lot in his life.
He has, and you know, again, a great example of, and once we get him in line, he'll be able to tell you this much better than
sure.
I can, who's taken advantage of the opportunity to be in a mortgage-free home to get on with rebuilding his lives. You know, a number of our guys have gone on to become small business owners. We have a number who are motivational speakers and quite effective at getting out and talking about their personal experiences and how they've overcome it,
mm-hmm.
and kind of keeping in line with your last guest, taking a very positive approach towards life and giving back and getting the benefit of going out and helping others. We have veterans that are now working as service officers in other organizations that help veterans with whether they're filing their claims or counseling and that sort of thing. We have two of our guys who played on the U.S. Olympic sled hockey team, Paralympic sled hockey team that won the gold medal against the Russians.
Fantastic. Bill, sorry for the interruption. And guess who we have on the phone here? Welcome, Justin Bond.
Thank you, sir.
Sorry. How are you, my friend?
Yeah, doing good, doing good.
Say hello to the executive director, Bill Ivey.
Hey, Bill, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Justin. How are you today?
Good, doing good.
Hey, Justin.
In this nice California heat.
Yeah, yeah. Justin, how's your new digs?
Man, it's amazing. It's life-changing. It's, you know, everybody always says that owning a home is the American dream, but I think it's so much more than a dream.
Fantastic. Well, you deserve every square foot of that and more. I mean, the life that you've led, getting shot in Fallujah in both knees, then signing up again to get reenlisted, and then ultimately losing both your legs. You paid the price, my friend.
Well, you know, it's been a blessing. I don't feel like we deserve everything that we get, but, you know, that's why we turned the house down the first time. But you know, I had to do it for my family, and it really has changed my family's life and my life, and it's allowed me to be able to step up and give back now and help out with other nonprofits and to create a nonprofit, and it's definitely been a blessing.
Why did you decline the home the first time, Justin?
Well, you know, there's so many more people out there that are injured that need it, and I just felt like, you know, it was pass it on to somebody else, but eventually I started feeling it's unfair to my family because, you know, my wife has to help take care of me, and so I did accept it in the end, and I'm glad I did because it's given me so much more energy. I used to have to hop to the bathroom. My wheelchair would not fit down the hallways or into the bathrooms. That's when I had, I still have one leg. We haven't amputated that one. We're going to, though. And
my apologies about that.
Yeah, no problem. And but this one is actually prolonging amputating that leg because now I don't have to hop everywhere.
Fantastic. Hey, Justin, talk about your psychological state, your outlook, and not so much, of course, what you endured being in Iraq for years, but more about returning home and thinking about the dismal future. Compare and contrast where you were then until you got this you approached, or Homes for Our Troops approached you and said, hey, listen, this is what we could do for you. I imagine you did a 180-degree turnaround.
Yeah, it was more like several 360s, because I didn't believe it was happening once it was there. And, you know, it was pretty grim. I didn't want to get up out of bed. I didn't want to take a shower. I would have to, when my other knee was out, I had to crawl to the toilet. I would, you know, get into the shower and fall. And now, you know, I get up. I can get ready on my own. I don't have to ask my wife for help. I can get up and make her breakfast in bed if I want to.
Good man, you know, good man.
Handicap. And so it gives me my freedom back, and it makes it to where I can be independent of myself, you know, without any help from other people.
So, Justin Bond, would it be fair to say there was life before the service and post-life after you've become disabled and you have a new lease on life and a way of living life differently?
Yeah, you know, I think I live life better now than before Iraq. You know, I have a new meaning and a new purpose. And it wasn't that way before I got the house, though. I was pretty bummed out and pretty depressed, and that's why the suicide rate is so high right now, because people are bummed out and they don't have that freedom. People are returning missing 2, 3, 4 limbs, and now life is good. I'm excited to wake up every day. I'm excited to keep going forward, and because of the home and because of not having to worry about having to somehow make the payments on a house and then not even be able to use the house, really, now I'm able to have that freedom to be able to really get out and give back.
And you're doing that in many ways. In addition to Homes for Our Troops, you are an elected official. Congratulations, my friend, on the new title of Supervisor of Kings County, District 4.
Thank you, sir.
Very good. Hey, Bill, he's doing a lot of things out there.
He is, absolutely. He's doing exactly what we hope our veterans can do, is get on with rebuilding his life and without the burden of a mortgage to pay. Justin, let me add my congratulations on winning that election.
Appreciate it. Yeah, we're going to keep going. We're going to keep doing good stuff. And I urge all the veterans to get up off the couch, start giving back. You know, don't use your disability as a crutch. And really, there's so much good stuff you can do out there. And, you know, we're warriors. You just got to pull that warrior from within and get out there and keep going.
Yeah, it takes a little time. Yeah, psychological barriers, physical barriers and hurdles, but I mean, there's help out there. I mean, and very quickly, we don't have much time, Justin, but I just want to get just a quick glimpse of, do you think our government is doing enough for our returning vets?
You know, some areas of the country they are, and other areas they're not. That's firmly what I believe. I believe the West Coast is doing it a lot better than the East Coast, and I believe that there are enough programs out there to really help us out. But they're not really showing the veterans how to get there. They're not connecting the dots, and the veterans have to already know about the stuff or stumble across it.
Sure, sure. Well, congratulations, Justin, on many fronts, because besides being an elected official, you're just an individual who perseveres, and that takes a lot in this world, especially when you have a challenge.
Yeah, well, we'll just keep going, doing what we got to do.
Yeah, yeah. Enjoy those homes, man, that new home of yours, for compliments of Homes for Our Troops. And what's the website, gentlemen?
It's at www.hfotusa.org.
Bill Ivey, Executive Director, and Justin Bond, Sergeant Justin Bond, congratulations on you know, being the recipient, and first of all, building these homes that are imperative for the success of our veterans.
Thank you, and I urge everybody to go to the website and to contribute, host a small fundraiser if they can, because there's so many more people that really need help right now.
All the best to you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Big congratulations going out to Nidhi Singh and Chris McHugh. They are tying the knot this weekend. Congratulations, my friends. And some other great things happening around here, of course. Ranger Mania continues on Friday. Special thanks, of course, to the superstars who make the show happen. Jason, Giselle, Casey. Gary Knowles next, if you'd like to book me for a college K-12 speaking engagement and more. Go on to MarkFarrellMotivation.com, MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Insight will be back next week. Happy Father's Day. Bask in what you guys do the best. Be a great parent. And my name is Mark Farrell. See you next Thursday. Cheers.